Hi everyone, this is Vrino van der Hals, and I would like to extend a warm welcome to everyone joining us for this session of the Enlightenment Conference. Today's session is with Kitabu Roshi, talking about Zen, Monsieur All, Arts, and Personal Power. The host for today's session is Vijudeva, a Zen priest and biblical mystic, who in his professional life guides corporate executives and business leaders. I'll turn it over to him. Vijudeva?
Hi, and thanks. Welcome to everybody who has joined us again today. I'd just like us to take a moment, gather together, to remember this image that we've been using of gathering around the campfire of our shared humanity. That these are a bit like fireside chats. And we talked about ourselves, gathering around the mitochondrial fire, solar systems and galaxies gathering around the campfire of suns, and we today gather around the campfire of our shared humanity and the discipline and devotion of each of our hearts. So I'm delighted to have Kitabu Roshi with us here today. I'd like to give you guys a little introduction to him as well, and just remembering that we're listening for the love and the devotion, the care and the concern that animates and guides each individual's life. So Kitabu Roshi has been known as a Christ-centered Zen and martial arts teacher. And that's a very interesting combination. He had studied with Nomura Roshi, and he also has studied with Sadhguru Sat Keshavadas. He's authored numerous books, and he has numerous videos, YouTube videos, and other places on the internet where you can see him doing his work. And today we have the delight of listening to him as he gives us some perspective on Zen, martial arts, and personal power. So without further ado, Kitabu Roshi, if you wouldn't mind, I would love to turn the floor over to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Viv. Appreciate it. One, I would like to say that coming to this path was one that was unexpected for me. And yes, I did grow up in a Christian community. And I believe in the power of peace and love, still do. But I also saw that there were victims in the world. And often these people were unsupported by those around them. I first became aware of this when I was 9 years old. I overheard my parents talking about a woman named Kitty Genovese from Queens, New York. And she was a housewife who was walking home from her evening job about 2 o'clock in the morning when she was attacked. A man stabbed her and she was able to run. She ran to her apartment building, knocked on the door of one of her neighbors. He saw that she was bleeding and closed the door. The attacker came in the building, pulled her back out into the street, and there were then sight of 200 neighbors in this high-rise apartment building. She was murdered. And I hate to be so graphic, but the facts all bear this out, that she was stabbed 27 times. As a child, listening to that, I was horrified. I was more horrified feeling for this woman who was so close to home and yet received no help. And so I made a prayer to God. And in my prayer, I said, please never let me walk away from a cry for help. Give me that ability to make a difference, and I will always use it to make a difference. And that's how it began, as a prayer. I didn't have any particular type of ability or anything, and how it followed from there was when there was a cry for help, I intervened. That is, if I saw a bully attacking someone, I intervened. The usual result was the victim got away, and I became the victim because I couldn't really defend myself, though I had the heart of the defender. I didn't have any ability to go along with it. And it seemed like that was a test. How far would I go becoming the victim in place of the victim, the substitute? And to really think about it, that also really fits into the Christian mode of the substitute. After a while, my father told me about Marsh Watson, particularly about a man named Master C. O'Neill, who was short in stature, but who had those abilities. And he was a police officer. And I went to see him. He gave me a demonstration of what he could do. And I was amazed by that. But more amazing, perhaps, being that he was a well-known teacher of people who later became members of the Hall of Fame, he didn't ask me to become a student. Instead, he encouraged me to pursue my own path. And that path I pursued many years later, a quarter of a century later, I was still pursuing it and still in contact with him. After meeting the Zen Master Nyingma Roshi, I found myself really deeply involved in meditation. I was always a contemplative person, but now even more so when I understood it was a path. Before, I didn't know it was a path. It's just something that I did. And in this experience, in this practice, something changed inside of me. Something transformed. And it came from the unconscious. Because the way I moved, the way I thought, the way I acted, the way I felt was no longer the same as before. I was still in that same mode of wanting to help people, only this time I found myself able to emerge victorious without effort. And more importantly, without any sense of vengeance or desire for such. It was 10 years after meeting Sadhguru and meeting Nyingma Roshi that I met Sadhguru Tsongkhapa. And when he met me, the very first meeting we had, he stood up and held out his arms and called me his son. And our journey began together, which lasted for about 20 years before he passed. The shift here was something very spiritual, very intuitive was taking place that was beyond my consciousness. Ability to see into the nature of things. The people, the predators, you might want to call them, to me were also people. And there was a desire in me to help them to grow, to get beyond this need to do harm. But I found out that sometimes you cannot do that just by speaking to a person, preaching to the person, appealing to their better nature. Some people worship power, and they want to be the ones that have it. And they gain respect when they discover they have no power over you. That's when a change comes about in them. So the Quran that was given to me was real life, real situations. I did not want that. It's not something I saw. I didn't want to be a martial artist. I was a poet. I was contented with writing and performing my portrait and keeping the other part a secret, using it only when necessary. But that changed in 1975 when my first book came out. And that book, which was poetry, was supposed to be called The Book of Kitabu. But the publisher, who happened to know a little about my background, decided to rename the book for one poem, this is the book that was in the book, Kung Fu the Master. I asked him, please don't do that. If you name the book that, it's going to make it me a target. And he said, oh, it's going to help sell the book. So he named the book Kung Fu the Master. And lo and behold, when I went on television or was written about in the newspaper, there was more emphasis put on the martial side than put on the poet side. And sure enough, people were testing me. They wanted to see if I could actually live up to the hype of the book. Now, what people didn't realize was that I was not a formal martial artist. I did not study karate, judo, jiu-jitsu, all of those things. I practiced Zen, and I had an awakening. In history, that is not unusual. You had Taekwondo. You had many samurai and people who had an awakening that gave them insight into this coming and going, this Bushido that transcended their training. But in the modern world, where everything is so laid out, choreographed, people have forgotten that or didn't know about it at all. So as this reputation grew, it was Master Neil who said to me, would you agree to a test? And the test was to satisfy the martial arts community. He wanted to present me before a board. And that board was to put me through what was called a trial by combat. And I agreed because I felt great. All I have to do is fail this and this will end. And they brought in black belts and other people, and there were masters present, and they put me through this test. And when the test was over, I was presented with formal black belt rankings in a couple of disciplines, and therefore the legitimacy was established. That was a good thing in that it supported the spiritual insight. These people who studied the discipline and respected it and loved it gave me the support and recognition of spiritual insight, and they made me the spiritual leader or director of that community, which became known as Budo. Now, inwardly, something happened. You go from a feeling of powerlessness. I can do nothing. I have no chance here. To a feeling of victory and possibility, in which you feel that anything is possible and it's okay. That's because when we are making decisions based really on our consciousness and on our learned ability, we also know what we don't know. We can say, I don't have the ability to deal with this. I never studied this. I never came in contact with this. But when you're embracing risk through emptiness, then you begin to adapt. I refer to it as mind like water. Whatever vessel you're in, you adapt to the shape of the vessel. When you can understand that your mind is adaptable, that you're not just a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher, a janitor, a waiter, you're not just that. You are whoever or whatever you have to be at that moment, simply because you recognize you are that, whoever you have to be at that moment. And if you allow that to happen for you, then you will go past your fear. We all move our arms and legs, blink our eyes, we turn, we walk, we run. Whoever we face does these things. Why must we assume that we are better at it than we are? When I hear of the cases that have been happening recently, and such as the movie theater tragedy at the opening of The Dark Knight, or the Sikh temple tragedy, I grieve for that. I grieve for the people involved and the families. But I also grieve because I know that we don't have to be okay. The situation can be dire, but we don't have to accept such fate. Because if we do learn to adapt, if we overcome our initial fear that we have, we can act with wisdom. And that does not mean taking on everyone in hand-to-hand combat. That's not necessarily what I mean by wisdom. Wisdom could mean getting away. But when people are shooting in the theater and you stand up, that's not wise, because you make yourself a target. That's a simple thing where people panic and therefore they act from that instinct to get up and run without considering what they're running from and how far it reaches. It is possible for us to be strong and peaceful and loving at the same time. We don't have to adopt the attitude of the violent and be like them, because their attitude tends to be destructive. They want to destroy. The original meaning behind Bushido, the way of the warrior, was to stop the battle. If you can meditate that on that for a moment, to stop the battle, that means you want to put an end to it. And you can put an end to things in many ways. You stop the threat, you change the attitude. But you can't do that unless you recognize that you are an instrument. And that's what we have to become. We have to be an instrument. If you are an instrument, then you can be used by the divine to accomplish things that you can't do on your own. It is like a symbiotic relationship. I have the power, but I have no body. you say, I have the body, but I don't have any power. So let's work together. When you learn that that's possible, you discover anything is possible there. And that's really been the lesson that I've been attempting to share for all these years, in spite of myself. And I keep asking, how did I get on this path? Because the answer is, Katie Genovese. I wouldn't want to see her or anyone like her slain again. So the question would be, what could I do? Maybe I could have yelled out the window. The police are on their way. Something simple. We deal with a lot of esoteric things, a lot of philosophical things. But there are a lot of real things that need our help. The path of the warrior is someone drops something on the ground and you pick it up and hand it to them. A person is hungry and you offer them some food. Being protective of people really means caring about them as souls. Developing that type of relationship. And when that kinship becomes strong, powerful, you become the big brother or the big sister, then you cannot stand by when something happens. And you're empowered to make that difference. I know that when people think of martial arts in general, they think of people hitting and kicking and fighting and all the different things we see in the ring. But I know really very little about that. That's not what I see. To me, I feel, as I say to my own students, that God has angels above and love and angels below. And then if you allow yourself to become an instrument, then you become an angel below. You are there if needed. That's what you're there for. Not to be a bully, but to speak softly, respectfully, to make people feel safe and to want to be around you. The Zen part is a path of unknowing. And I know a lot of people know a lot about Zen, but that's not the same thing as knowing Zen. Because if you really know Zen, you don't know anything. It is like being on the river in a sailboat waiting for the wind to come. When it comes, you know, because the boat is moving. When that experience kicks in, you know because something is different than it was before. And this is something that you come to appreciate over time at moments when it happens for you. do you realize, oh, it's still there. I think one of the most significant times that that power kicked in was many years ago when I was on a bus. And I was reading a book. And there was a woman sitting across from me with two babies. One baby was on her lap, and the other one was sitting, leaning next to her. The bus hit some kind of a depression in the street, and the baby she wasn't holding flew up in the air. I set the book down, moved across the distance, caught the baby, put the baby down beside her, and went back to the seat, picked up my book, and started to read before I realized all those things had been done. Because it happened so fast, so accurate, that I could never have done it consciously. Because the moment I looked up and saw a baby in the air, I probably would have said, oh my God, and that would have been too late. So in that instant, everything came together. That's what Zen experience is like when it happens. You can't take credit for it, not really. But the practice that you're doing, just meditating, Musu Toko, just meditating, it's a preparation for that time when prajna, the Sanskrit word, wisdom, prajna, kicks in. And prajna is not just the ability to recite information, but also contains in it an active power to act on that. To me, this is the real thing there, that as long as I know that I know nothing, but I'm open to experiencing that support, then I boldly go into the situation, empty-handed. Expecting that it'll be there when I get there. The wisdom to diffuse the situation or get out of the situation will be there. Everyone can't do it. I know that. Everybody won't do it. But if one person can, then one person can help a lot of people. I was talking to my own students after this incident in the theater and giving them demonstrations of what possibilities exist. I said, you have one person with his weapon. He can't face 360 degrees. He has to walk past to get to somewhere else. If everybody is not afraid, if somebody gets behind him, can distract him even for a moment, there's the possibility that other people could help. And that we have seen that happen before. But we wouldn't lose so many people. So, in a real way, that path is sacrificial. It goes back to that sacrificial. You know that there is a possibility that it might not end well for you. But the love is stronger than the fear. That is precious. A few months, and this is what, we don't want to believe things like this happen. Yet we know they do. We want to, and we do believe in love and PC, all those things. But there is an opposite for us that does not believe in love and peace and all those things. They are also real. The people who are on the borderline, we can perhaps help them to change. But those who are committed to their path will not change. They can only be neutralized by our presenting a strong force. And when I say force, I don't mean violence. I mean to be strong. We have to be able to do that. A few months ago, I was out of the country. I came back, and I learned that one of my dear friends in the martial arts world was dead. There are people, guys, who know that has happened. But the tragedy was that he was murdered. He was attacked in his house by a gang of men, and they killed him, eventually, because he died in the hospital. Now, knowing him, knowing his reputation, knowing his ability, that was very disconcerting. You could say, how is it possible to make it to this? Terrible. Well, not long after that, I was attacked on the street one night by three men. And naturally, you start to think about what just happened to your friend. And they attacked me, and the thing that was important for me was to never show any sign whatsoever of fear or concern. To talk to them. The talking wasn't enough, and one of them got angry and said, "Hold him, I'm going to go get my gun." Well, they weren't able to hold me, and the guy who was going to get the gun had to come back to help him. And the way it ended was, all three of them ran. This would have been the end of the story. It was reported to the police and all, except one thing. A few days later, the guy who said he was going to get his gun was all over the news, wanted for murder, because he killed the very next victim by shooting him to death. So he wasn't bluffing. And before I knew this information, I felt this incredible negative force in me, and I told my students about it. I said, in all the battles I've been in, there's something unusual about this, as if I came in contact with satanic force. The difference was that these men were intent on killing me. That was their agenda. And I feel it. But, by the grace of God, Prajna kicked in again, and they ran, and I stood my ground. And that was a lesson, because after years of being in benevolent situations and demonstrating for people who want to learn, who have a positive attitude, it was definitely a lesson to be around people who had the same kind of attitude that destroyed the life of Chitty Genovese, where it all began. And it made me realize, once again, that we do have to be vigilant. We have to realize that we can be very good, just be mindful that there are those who are not so good. That if they think we are slack on our vigilance, then innocent people phone. We don't have to. It's not a matter of intent. It's just a matter of being aware. If someone offers you a glass of water, it's different from a soda or a cold beer. It's different. Could be you don't drink soda. Could be you don't drink beer. But chances are you drink water. We respond according to necessity. And therefore, we need to not be so rigid. That's, we need to not lock ourselves into a pattern that makes it impossible for us to move to the left or to the right. I was in the community of Sakuru Sankesha for 20 years. And no one saw me fight. There wasn't anything in my consciousness to want to meditate on or anything. And yet, jokingly, the master would call me the karate guru and all that. He said that. But it wasn't because of anything he saw in the way of us. Because I thought my nature was like his. Peace, love. I would prefer to drown my enemies with my tears. But this sword aspect was given for a purpose. There's a scripture in it that says, for God has not given us a spirit of fear, but the power and love and of a sound mind. But it's something that a lot of people probably don't know. Christ said to his disciples, he asked them if they had the sword. And then he said, if you have no sword, sell your robe and buy a sword. Because there comes a time when the sword may be necessary. Not desired, but necessary. For our purpose to utilize that image, the sword, not go around cutting people up, but as an extension of one's spirit, to reach out around to sharpen one's mind and spirit. It can be weapon enough. It's the way we apply ourselves. And they go out into the world, the sun is shining, the birds are singing, the grass is green, everything is perfect, so it seems. You drive your car carefully, because someone isn't. So we're given the ability to lengthen, to conserve our life through vigilance. And to that degree, that's all the warrior that really is. Because it's not really about fighting at all. It's about your own sensitivity, your own alertness. Catching the baby. So the baby won't be hurt. And you can do that. So, too many of us to get in our way. Because then all we're doing is focusing on them rather than on our environment itself. Another thing, it all feels very good. It feels very good to have a sense of readiness. And it's a constant reminder that we are really, truly not alone. Physical and the invisible have complementary relationship, the left hand and the right hand. The open hand, the closed fist. All in one person. I wrote a new book. It came out in May, and it's called Under the Sword. And the sad thing about it was that this book actually deals with the kind of things that were to happen just a couple months later in the theater and in the Sikh community and others. And it was an attempt to teach people the kind of mindfulness that can save your lives. And I know these things work because I used to run home from school all the time trying to get there before the police got to me. And the thing that changed was me. And once I changed, the bullies changed. It became rather amusing when I grew up, come back to the old neighborhood, and some guy would come up and put his arms around me and introduce me as his best friend. He was one of the guys who used to beat me up. For some reason, he had forgotten all about that. It was our change. So all of this goes together. The person who unfortunately grows up to be a predator, and the bullies to be facing our younger lives. We can't always directly transform a bully by simply telling him that's not nice because he isn't trying to be nice. you refused to be a victim, when you were no longer a victim, then the bully has no one to attack because she comes after the weak. It's all in how we approach ourselves. In the mirror, you see the raw material. But you can see the raw material of someone that's on the losing side, or you can see the raw material of someone who's great. The nature of the mind and its attributes are universal. How we perceive them and the ego on them may be very different. So we can have two people with equal skills, and one who believes in their skill and uses them accordingly, and one who believes they are doomed to failure and approaches it that way. Confidence can be felt. Confidence can be seen. It radiates out. There is no substitute for believing in ourselves, the potential. There's nothing egocentric about it, because we didn't make any part of ourselves. It's like believing in mountains, believing in star systems. We too are part of that. So if we allow that sense of connectedness to penetrate, we're going to walk a little differently. And our life, our lives, will begin to change. And not all of it is going to be at the conscious level. You can't wrap your thoughts around everything. That's where faith comes in. I like the phrase, have faith in your mind. You can jump in your car and you start it up. You really expect to go somewhere. You expect the engine to fire off, the wheels to turn. When you engage in an activity, you should expect your mind to go into the action. Don't pull it back, then that becomes dualistic. Scripture says a double mind is unstable in all of its ways. The Zen used to say the conflict between good and evil is the disease of the mind, torn back and forth. So when things come out from that consciousness, it will drive you so far, and then the unconscious kicks in, and will drive you a little further. When I was a boy, I was on my way to the movies. And I had my head down looking into my hands, my chains. And another woman came up to me and asked me for some money. And I said, get away from me. No. And he ran. And I looked back and realized he was a bully. And I didn't even know I was speaking to him. But at that moment, I spoke what I was feeling, and he ran. I would not have had that courage if I had looked up and seen who was coming. Not then. That's just a little sample of how things move inside of us. But it can be in other areas of the life, in creativity, in work, facing various situations. And leave yourself relaxed and open to input. And let it happen. We are wonderful and wonderfully made, and we're in a position to remake, to reprogram, if you will, those areas that we're not pleased with. It's like going back to school. It's a path of realization, knowing that there are so many possibilities to reach, but nothing's more exciting than your own transformation. Just remember that you're credit. And when credit is due, I know nothing, yet everything is done. And it's done years ago. Let us be our brother's keeper, our sister's keeper. We're keeping ourselves or ourselves aware, alert, and open. Josh. Good?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Itabu Roshi, thank you for that. Thank you for that talk. What we'd like to do now, and I have some submitted questions that have already come in, but we'd like to invite you guys, if you'd like to be part of the conversation, if you'd like to directly ask Itabu Roshi a question or engage him in dialogue, just press 1 on your phone now, and you will come up. We will see you, and we will patch you in. So please do that right now as you are moved, as you are called, as you are inspired. And then, Kitabu, I have some written questions. If you would be willing to engage them in dialogue for a bit, would that be fine?
Yes.
So I'm going to start back a bit towards the end of what you were saying. You were talking about how bullies changed as you changed. And so the question is about bullies, and it's about sort of the difference between potentially physical bullies and emotional bullies. So here's the question. When you speak of bullies changing when you change, does that apply equally to emotional bullies as it does to physical bullies? That's our first question.
Well, the physical bully is an emotional bully also, because you become intimidated. Only difference is they include the the attack aspect, and that must be dealt with in a separate way. But yes, a person can only bully a person who receives their attack. You have to feel like they're being affected to reach you. And when you, in the case of emotional attack, when you can ward that off by not responding, by not giving any open reaction to it, they will feel it being ineffective and move on.
Yeah. Thanks.
Okay.
I have a few other questions here. One of them, the next question submitted, would be, the path of the warrior, as you describe it, sounds a lot like the path of service. It sounds like you're adding protector, sort of like Big Brother. But beyond protection from physical harm, what other ways can we practice being protectors? Or what other ways can we practice to be protectors?
Well, what I said earlier was, if a person drops something, you pick it up. If they're hungry, you feed them. It's really reaching out to the souls around you. The situations determine what the action should be. No, you can't know beforehand. It's not a formula.
Yeah, that's great. And it looks, I think we have a caller who'd like to dialogue with you for a bit, too.
Hi, this is Aaliyah. So enjoying this talk. It's more meaningful since I studied a little tiny bit of Aikido. And my question is, if we don't practice and learn martial arts, what is it that gives us that strength and that inner confidence? Is it love, the kind of love that the Christians talk about? And are there disciplines and practices and exercises to acquire that kind of love?
Well, you understand what I'm saying?
Did you repeat it? The connection just broke up a little bit, so if you could repeat part of the answer, that would be great.
Love being real and not practice. It's that reaching out with your heart by embracing other people and your heart becomes filled with that.
Yes.
So it's not always like I would.
Yeah, the transmission of your the transmitting of your voice is breaking up electronically here, but I do understand, and thank you so much.
Yeah, I would like to thank you for your appreciation and for your question, Aaliyah. That was a great question, and I think that brings out, I know you're talking about love, and Sebastian was talking about love, and I think that goes to the heart of what the whole talk is about today. So as we're sort of losing the line, we're losing the mic, I would just like to thank everyone for spending that time with us today and sort of in devotion and reverence with us here at the Enlightenment Conference. I'm going to turn it back over to Freno if he has any announcements on what's coming next. And just thank you all so much. Big breath, big bow, big hug, and I hope to see you all soon. So I'll turn this over to you, Freno, and then we can close out. Thanks.
Okay, thank everybody for joining us today. Unfortunate with the sound at the end, but that's how it goes sometimes. Thanks everybody for joining, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Thanks. See you, everyone.